All right, Jack, you want to start us off?
Yeah. Are we ready to go?
Yep.
All right. Welcome to the PC Gamer Podcast, episode 80 for the week of April 23rd, 2007, coming to you pre-recorded from our studio in South San Francisco. I'm your host, Senior Executive Editor Chuck Osborne, and today we have with us Executive Editor Kristen Salvatore.
Hi there.
Senior Associate.
I thought we were doing our greetings.
Oh, Chuck. No, it's me. I'm sorry. I just haven't hosted for so long.
My bad.
Senior Associate Editor Dan Stapleton.
Hiya.
Backspace Columnist Gary Witta.
Wait, so we are doing greetings now?
Great greeting. And from the windy city of Chicago, our producer, Jeremy Williams.
Hey, everybody.
Our special guest this week is Mike Legg, the president of Petroglyph, who will be talking with Dan later on about Universe at War, Earth Assault. So I guess today the big news of the week is that MPD Group, a market research firm that tracks sales figures, released a report saying that the domestic retail sales for PC games reached $203 million during the first 2 months of 2007, which is a 48% increase over last year's $136.8 million generated during the same time frame. That also doesn't include revenue generated by digital distribution online or any online subscriptions. So, you know, it's great that it's happening, but nobody seems to know exactly why. So I'm going to put it to you guys. Is it because of Burning Crusade? Is it Microsoft's new initiatives? Or do you think the games are just better this year?
Well, that doesn't even include WoW revenue, right?
Right. It doesn't include WoW revenue, but like I'm saying, it also doesn't include... Well, I mean, it does include retail sales of Burning Crusade.
Yeah. Box copies, yeah.
Right.
But not subscription.
Right. Not subscription.
Right. Whose big idea was it not to include online sales in retail sales figures? I mean, isn't that the same thing?
It's NPD. Well, mainly because they have a difficult time trying to get those figures, but also they just haven't been asking, as far as I can tell.
I think part of the problem is that private companies like Valve don't have to give that information out.
Mm.
So if they can't count it all, they just don't bother counting it at all.
And also for a lot of companies, you know, it pretty much amounts to ratings, and so they kind of want to keep that information, you know, to themselves. Even though, you know, it would kind of help the PC gaming industry as a whole if they were more forthright and came out with that information.
But I mean, it's great news. I mean, it's still. They were projecting that it would come out to about $1 billion this year in PC gaming revenue, which you know is great. Although next to consoles, we're still a niche market really. But they had like $9 billion expected, so it's great news for us though, because you know it had been in decline for the last few years, but now it's on its way back up, and it's probably got to do with games like WoW and CNC3 and Supreme Commander and all these other games that are selling really well according to some top selling lists I've seen recently.
I wonder if it also has to do with the fact that, and this is sort of gets referenced in the article, for a lot of people who want to play games but don't feel like dropping all the money on a console, most people already have a PC. So
right, and like the
really
Sims 2 expansions.
Out.
Sims 2 expansions just keep coming out and keep dominating the top 10, top 20 lists. So.
I like
yeah,
this
but the most of the people that have a PC, just like a regular PC just for office work, if they want to play games on it, you're probably talking about as much as it would cost to buy a console to get your PC up to, you know,
well, it depends on
what
you're
playing. Games properly.
It depends on what you're playing. Like this, like the article specifically says, this particular gentleman goes in and he's a 3-year-old Dell. He goes in and buys Civ 4.
Do they mention Peggle?
Peggle does not come up, which is shocking. Me.
That's the good thing about Peggle, though. No high-end graphics card required.
Yeah.
Well, and also Peggle wouldn't even be counted because I think most people would get that digitally.
Online. Right.
Yeah, or right. Through Steam. It's available through Steam as well.
Or through our
Are they not yet caught up with the music industry where downloads count in
no.
terms of sales figures?
No, not
they need,
yet.
They need to get on that.
That's what I'm saying. Does iTunes report that? Do they get included in music sales?
Yeah.
I think they must, because I remember hearing on... I don't know, like American Idol the other week, where they were talking about someone having the number one most digitally downloaded, you know, single of the week or something.
In the, I mean, it's definitely happening in other countries as well. I mean, there was a little bit of a news story a year or so ago when the Gnarls Barkley song, Crazy, went to number one in the UK. That was the first song that went to number one off downloads.
So in other news, right now, probably right now as we speak, Richard Garriott and famed physicist Stephen Hawking are together aboard the Vomit Comet, flying in near space.
Nerds in space!
So that Stephen Hawking can have a weightless experience. I believe that Richard Garriott, Lord British to Ultima fans, has done this before already, but for some reason he got paired with Stephen Hawking this time, and apparently they had a bit of difficulty trying to figure out exactly how to do it. And hopefully we will hear later on today exactly what happened, because...
You mean with the wheelchair and all?
Well, yeah, because they didn't know whether they would have to keep him strapped down,
yeah,
or how exactly they were going to handle it. And I think what they finally ended up doing, because they did a test flight with a dummy. And so I think right before the descent, you know, before the weightlessness begins, a couple of his handlers were going to kind of like unstrap him or something so he could kind of experience some weightlessness.
Yeah, I guess they actually built a sort of specially built kind of bed. I guess it's like a bed. It's sort of a cushion that he's attached to, strapped into during the initial part of the flight. There was an article about it in the Chronicle today.
Do you suppose while they're up there, they'll come up with any good collaborative game ideas?
Right.
With, you know, something physics based.
Well, that would be awesome. What an opportunity, you know. It's like Garriott's up there. He can just say, "So, do you ever play any games? And do you have any ideas?"
Except that Stephen Hawking won't actually be able to talk up there because his computer is not coming with him.
Hmm. Well,
so
maybe
he's not
he can.
Be able to. His assistant is bringing some alphabet cards, I guess, and a laptop to try to help him if he wants to talk. But the apparatus that he actually usually uses to speak, he can't bring with him. So,
go ahead and rain on our parade.
You wouldn't even need like a full alphabet, though. You would just need cards that say things like "holy shit" and "we."
Right. Yeah. And like "barf." Right. Exactly.
Okay. Well, that kind of destroys the illusion, because I was imagining him floating down the airplane, going, "Stephen Hawking coming at you, out of the way." They both like space. I know as part of Tabula Rasa, Richard Garriott actually created an entire language. I think it's 1,000 different characters right now, and it's a symbolic language that he created that would be understandable by any bipedal sentient being, or at least learnable by any bipedal sentient being.
So maybe that's what he and Stephen Hawking are... That's how they're conversing.
Maybe he's going to teach Stephen Hawking right. that language, and then, you know, Stephen could, like, have a new way of communicating. I don't know.
Garriott is definitely fascinated by space. I remember I was at his house once. He's got this wacky house out in Austin with all kinds of secret doors and passages and weird memorabilia, and he has a plaque he bought at auction. I don't know how exactly you do this, but he bought several years ago one of the moon rovers that's still kind of sitting up there, you know,
yes.
derelict on the surface of the moon. And he has a little plaque that says, you know, he's the owner of it.
Yeah,
so
I was just
definitely
like he can go up and drive it if he wants to,
yeah,
or what?
But, you know, he technically, it's his.
Yeah, actually, I was just down there a couple weeks ago, and he showed me that same plaque. He said that he is the only private citizen to own something in space.
I'm totally going to ask him if I can borrow that next time I see him, if I can take that for a ride.
Yeah, but you have to get to the moon first, though.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the bipedal language. I mean, can tripods not understand this?
Well, because there had to be some concessions to, like, what a being looks like.
Right.
You know,
okay,
to make some of the symbology work. That's all.
Right. So it's a pictographic thing, and this, I like the way he was describing it in Tabula Rasa. It's like you don't actually have to learn the language yourself. It will translate it for you as you gain an experience. Is that right?
Yes. Although, I mean, I'm predicting right now that there are going to be several sites, if you know there aren't already, that will be tracking the language.
There are, because remember when we saw the game, they gave us that little coin that has a message on it.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenge coin, I found out from Richard, actually.
That's right.
Because he presented it to me, and I didn't have one on me. And apparently, if you challenge somebody with the coin who you know they have a coin as well, and they don't have it on them, then they owe you a drink.
So, really?
Yeah, so I now owe Lord British a drink.
If I had known that, I'd have been carrying the thing all the time.
I'm not sure that really works.
I don't know if that works in the bar. Like, you would just walk up to somebody and like, hey, can I see your tabula rasa challenge coin?
I challenge you. Buy me a drink. Tuesday was the launch of the Lord of the Rings Online. I don't know if anybody else has been playing that yet. To celebrate, the CEO of Midway, David Zucker, rang the closing bell at the New York Stock Exchange. There's a pretty funny picture on the official Lord of the Rings Online site about it, because not only are there a bunch of suits up there, as you'd expect, but there's also Gandalf and Frodo and I think, like, you know, one of the other bad guys is up there.
They totally fit in.
they look a little embarrassed.
Although, to be at the stock exchange?
Well, I'm not sure whether to be at the stock exchange. Well, I'm not talking about the suits. I'm talking about the guys in costume.
Oh, oh.
The guys who are forced to do cosplay at the New York Stock Exchange.
How do you explain that to your mom? Like,
yeah.
It's like, Mom, don't watch TV today.
Yeah.
No. But I mean, the day after these guys are there, the Dow closed above 13,000, right? So they're doing something, right?
That's what the stock exchange needs, more Frodo.
Yeah.
Well, no, obviously a wizard did it.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So. Right. Oh, my mistake.
Anyone know how the sales on that game are?
No, because it just went on sale, so...
I don't want to spell doom for this game by jinxing it or anything, but it does seem like they've had a fairly positive launch. I've played it a little bit, and to be honest, I don't think it's for me, but a lot of people that I know who are into Warcraft and other games have really taken to it, and they seem to like it, and it seems like they're doing some cool things with the game. I like the idea of the kind of the founder lifetime membership and being able to carry your character over from beta if you pre-order. They've done lots of smart little things with the launch of this game, it seems like.
Gaz, you're not willing to give it a whirl now that you've taken a break from your old gaming
program? I gave it a whirl. I gave it a whirl. I was in the world test, like the 2-week open beta, and I ran around.
So were all of our readers.
Yeah, right. I had a character, and you know, it's like it's so hard for me to invest in another MMO, and I'm in that category. But I think there's another category of people who are, you know, are kind of more open to something that's not Warcraft and want to try something different. And obviously it does have a massive, massive license behind it. And I think they've done some smart things. Like I said, I don't want to jinx it, but it feels like this could be the first MMO to come out since Warcraft that actually makes some kind of dent.
I had a character on there during the beta. And they give you naming guidelines. They don't want, you know, somebody running around with the name like Uber Leech Noob.
Frodo.
Yeah.
Right.
So they give you like a list of, you know, you pick your character race, and it gives you a list of, you know, these characters have names that end in, you know, such and such. And
what happens if you do try to create a character that's called like Hobbit Balls Lol or something? Do the
GM comes over to you and smacks you.
Yeah. They send someone to your house.
They skin your Hobbit feet off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Send them to gaming journalists.
So my character, I created a female elf hunter that I named Benadryl. Just to see if that would fly. I was playing for a few days, and it seemed to stick so far. So.
That's kind of funny, because I like that. Yeah. I like that it does actually sound like a Tolkien-esque name. But you can get... You're not allowed to have brand names or anything, are you? So they can probably get you on that.
Well, I misspelled it.
So I'm going to take this opportunity to go ahead and also plug our June issue, which has a covered story of the ultimate starter guide to the Lord of the Rings Online, Shadows of Angmar. So if you are playing the Lord of the Rings Online, unlike
Gary... Or plan to.
or plan to. There's actually, I must say, I wrote the story, but there's a lot of very fun information in there. So if you are planning on playing it, or if you have already, go ahead and pick up an issue.
I like all the stuff about the music.
Yeah.
I like all the music guides. That was really good stuff.
Or if, you know, you want to see anything else in the issue, by all means. There's a lot of good stuff in that issue, actually.
Oh, and another thing, you also get two exclusive Lord of the Rings Online in-game items in that issue. So I should tell everyone that, because, you know, even if you aren't planning on playing it, you're going to want to go out and buy a copy of it just so you can get those two in-game items and then not play it.
I got to tell you, though, the thing that most interested me in that issue was Chuck's Team Fortress 2 hands-on.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that sounded pretty cool, Chuck.
It does. Well, more than sounds pretty cool. It actually played pretty cool. I had a good time playing that. You know, I'm really looking forward to a lot of the stuff that Valve has coming out right now, because I like that, and I loved Left 4 Dead as well, which is...
I'm really looking forward to Left 4 Dead.
Is that the zombie game?
Yes, yeah. It is.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that.
That's because you love zombies.
I know, but I think more than anything, I'm looking forward to Team Fortress 2. What are they saying now about when that's coming out?
Well, it's coming out along with Episode 2, so that's going to be
and
this
Portal,
fall.
Right?
Yeah, and Portal. So it's going to be coming out this fall.
Are they still talking $40?
Yes.
Is that what I heard? What a deal.
And that's an awesome deal.
Simultaneous launch, too, right?
It's all one. Oh, yeah,
three
all,
great
yeah.
games for the price of less than the price of one.
I mean, on the consoles and PCs, so all on one day.
I don't know if it's coming on the PS3, is it?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe just Xbox.
No, they also. I mean, they're supporting the PS3. I don't know. It's going to be weird for Team Fortress 2, because I don't know what state PS3 Online is going to be by then.
Team Fortress 2 looks so fun.
Yeah,
I cannot wait.
I actually really like the art style. I was
a
big fan of The Incredibles, and you know, it obviously takes a few cues from that. So I'm looking forward to it.
And, you know, before I went to go see it, I was incredibly skeptical, because I was like, well, why are they going with this art style?
And now you've changed your mind, haven't
but
you?
But now I have totally changed my mind. After going down there, after playing it, after hearing the reasons why, it really does make sense, because they wanted to make it so that, you know, instead of like in most games where you look around and everybody looks pretty much the same except for the weapon that they're holding, in this game you can just automatically tell by looking at a character, okay, what class he is, what he can do, you know, all that stuff.
Is it in a state where they could release it if it was a solo release?
No, not completely, because there were still a couple of maps that they were working on still. Most of the maps were done.
I meant mostly in terms of the balancing between the different players. The different play types.
Actually, right now it seemed very balanced.
Cool.
To be honest with you, I know that they're going to be polishing the game up until they release it, but I was very impressed with just how balanced it was, even at this state, you know, like 6 months before it comes out. I noticed that last weekend, Intel brought out three new Core 2 CPUs. The difference this time is that they seem to be very cheap. Looks like the new Core 2 Duo E4400 is selling for less than $150 online, which seems like an incredible deal.
Well, and the news isn't so much that they put out new ones, it's they dropped the prices on the existing ones. So you can get a Core 2 Duo for like $120. Yeah, that's just amazing to me, considering how expensive, like...
how much is memory right now? Like, RAM?
About
RAM
the same,
It's about $100 a gig, and depending on the quality, and you can go up to $150 a gig, but, it varies. To get a dual-core CPU for this price is, I mean, I just don't know where to go with that.
I'm just shocked. I'm just completely wrong.
I have no words.
Well, one thing I've noticed, you know, because I edit all the reviews that come through here, and I've noticed over the last several months that the recommended system requirements have just been creeping up and up and up, and Core 2 Duos are becoming, or Core Duos are becoming, definitely the recommended spec for a lot of games. And I noticed even Halo 2, which is a 3-year-old Xbox game, the PC version, we're recommending that you have a Core Duo CPU for it.
You know, I suspect that that's not because of Halo 2, but because of the requirements of Vista. I mean, Vista doesn't require a dual core, but it will run better on a dual core. So, I mean, it does definitely help, and Vista is optimized to handle multi-core processors. So, I think that's probably the reason Microsoft recommends it and why we're recommending it.
I'd love to hear when people are sending in their letters this month, I'd love to hear, or this week, I should say, how many of our readers have already upgraded to Vista. So, just as a little call out, if you've already made the upgrade, send us a letter and let us know what you think of it. I'm real curious.
Also, another great thing on this list. This is an article from firingsquad.com. They list the prices, the previous prices of the chips, and then the new price for Q207, quarter 207. And the low end quad core was previously $851. Now it's $530, and that's huge drop, and it's putting it into temptation range even for somebody who wants to build a great new system.
Yeah.
So, wow.
I didn't expect these kind of drops until they came out with Penryn, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But that's not due for at least 6 more months, right?
Yeah, it's like they're really trying to stick it to AMD because yeah. AMD's dual cores were already more expensive than Intel's, and this is just salt in the wound.
Worked for me. I'm replacing my AMD stuff with Intel this afternoon.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, that means we'll be able to host more people in a Skype call.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. That's true.
So people at home are going to benefit from this.
Yeah. So, Jeremy, what did you get?
I got the 6600.
So that's the second highest model of the Core 2 Duo you got.
Yes. Yeah, it was the best, most bang for the buck right now, I think.
Right. Did you look at a bunch of benchmarks and everything before you pulled the trigger on that?
I looked at the Newegg reviews pretty much, and that was by far the best selling. And since the price had just come down, I grabbed it. $200.
That's the one that Will Smith recommended to me when I was looking into building a new PC.
Yeah, it's a very nice chip.
Mainly, I upgraded to an 8800 GTS last week, and I wasn't seeing the frame rates that I expected and wanted. So I figure I'm CPU limited. So
right.
So yeah, if the podcast is delayed this evening, this is why.
excuses.
Yeah, don't take apart your computer until you edit the podcast.
And you're certainly not playing Peggle, right?
I have every day.
Are you still?
Yeah, it really pushes that 8800. I'm telling you.
Well, something that could actually push your 8800 is Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare is going to be debuted on ESPN of all channels this Saturday, April 28th, during the broadcast of the NFL Draft at 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. Eastern. From what I understand, apparently this one will actually be appearing on PC. Unlike Call of Duty 3, which was on consoles only.
Well, that wasn't even developed by Infinity Ward, was it?
Right.
Yeah. This is back to the original team. So, and they actually have some PC left. So,
and also, the big news is, from the title, it looks like they finally moved out of World War II.
Yeah, I mean, why would they possibly not want to make another World War II game?
I can't
imagine.
The world
needs more. More. I'm just interested to see how they're going to differentiate it from, every other, like the Battlefield 2 kind of thing. How are you?
Well, and modern, modern is a very open term, really. I mean, what does that doesn't imply a particular time frame.
Well, don't...
Modern means now.
It's going to differentiate itself by being single player, right? I mean, these guys do single player action war games like nobody else. I can't wait to see this. It's going to be fantastic.
And Call of Duty has always kind of differentiated itself by being very story personality driven,
right.
and following usually three different people, I think, in the stories. And so I imagine they're going to be doing something similar with this just, now or maybe, sometime in the last 20 or 30 years. Well, more potential good news for PC gamers is that there was a fire at Human Head Studios.
That's not a good news.
Wow.
No. Those were the guys who made Prey. But no, I'm getting to the good news. That was the bad news. The good news is that they said that no one was injured, and more importantly, that there was no significant data loss. So
data loss is more important than physical injury to people?
When it comes to PC gaming, yes. I'm going on record as saying that.
That's some dedicated stuff right there. The human head guy, in the burning building, the choice between pulling out one of his buddies or grabbing the servers with all the game data on it. He goes for the game data. You can always hire another programmer, right?
Well, that's true, yeah. You can always hire
another
programmer.
Well, they can probably
programmer.
Still programmed while horrifically burned, but that data, there's no way to replace it.
Human beings are a dime a dozen.
I read that all of the chemicals in the human body are worth about 7 euros.
What?
Yeah.
It's just arranging them properly.
But doesn't that say that we're so much more than the sum of our parts, Jeremy?
I guess you could.
Do you want to get philosophical
way.
About it?
But we don't.
Must we?
Doesn't compare to a hard drive.
Now I have to turn that around on myself too. If there was a fire here, people would be much more worried about like any unfinished reviews that I had done, like anything that was on my hard drive, I think, than actually saving me. And I would be fully be behind that. So if anybody sees me burning or on fire, just grab my computer and run.
We're just one big happy family here at PC Gamer.
The thing Chuck left out of that is that it's us that would have set him on fire. So.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Was there any information on what caused the fire?
I think it was an adjoining business that I read that it wasn't actually their fault. So, but like they say, the fire was mostly on the other end of the building from them. So it was very little damage that they actually got. But it makes you wonder, like if you're working on a game like a massive development project, do they back it up like offsite?
Hmm.
I mean, and like it's got to be a massive backup operation because there's got to be gigabytes of stuff they'd want to update, backup every day.
But since they're the developers of Prey, from the end of Prey, it looks like there should be a Prey 2 coming out. So hopefully that means that Prey 2 is still in development and safe and sound. So apparently, from reading rumors on the web, like you're wont to do.
There's rumors on the interwebs.
Yeah, on the internets. There's a guy in San Diego who's claiming to have hacked the X10.
Well, yes. I guess
he's claiming to have reverse engineered it and figured out how to get it to run on Windows XP. Now, it's totally unsubstantiated that he's pulled this off, and there's and until he actually put something out, and he says he wants to charge for it.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. Usually, you hear about these stories, and they just put it out on the web and let people do what they want. But
I mean, look how easy this is to do. I also claim to have hacked the X10.
But that's the thing, though. If this were to happen, and it could possibly happen, who knows? Someday it'll happen. Would you do this instead of buying Windows Vista?
A lot of people would, I think, just because at this point, Vista is not as perfected as and stable as Windows XP is. Like, a lot of people are very set in their Windows XP ways and don't see any need to change yet. And there arguably isn't a huge need to change except for DirectX 10 for gamers. And if they can transition it over, there would be no real need to upgrade in the near future.
Isn't it also likely that Microsoft or game developers are going to have other checks for Vista besides just the X10 in their games?
Oh yeah, that's for games that require Vista. This is just games that would require DirectX 10. Those are two entirely different things. Crysis, for example, is not going to require Vista, but if you run it in Vista, it will turn on DX10. So presumably what this guy is saying he can do is make it run DX10 in Windows XP. So, and it if you don't have this and run Crysis in Windows XP, you just get DX9 effects.
Well, if it works, I think it's a nail in the coffin for Microsoft.
Sorry.
Wouldn't it be, though? Because the only reason anyone needs to buy Vista right now is to play games on it.
Right now.
Yeah.
But, in the near future, they will probably roll out more of the stuff they had planned that didn't make it to launch, and hopefully there will be more incentive, and also they're planning on pulling the plug on XP support in the next couple of years. So, eventually everybody's going to be on Vista, like it or not. So I'm here with Mike Legg, president of Petroglyph, the developers of Star Wars Empire at War for LucasArts, and they're currently working with Sega on Universe at War Earth Assault, which is a featured preview in our June issue. So Mike, how you doing? How's Vegas?
Oh man, Doing great. It's a beautiful day here in Vegas. The cold weather's gone. It's warming up. Looks like some pool party and barbecue action this weekend. And we are having a total blast working on Earth Assault. We're just having a great time here.
So do you want to give our audience a quick rundown on the game?
Okay, yeah. Universe at War Earth Assault is a brand new RTS, a brand new intellectual property, all new story. It is a it's been created from scratch. It's been created with all new technology. We've taken our engine from Empire at War and really, really, really advanced it and taken it to the next stage in terms of gameplay, networking, and graphics, and really advanced our technology and made this new RTS that we are just in love with. The battlefield is Planet Earth. The year is 2012. And basically, man is about to get invaded and get his butt kicked. We've got three extremely cool factions that we are just digging. Sega has let us just go absolutely crazy, especially the designers, in creating these new factions and this new story for the battlefield of Earth. The first faction that probably everybody's seen, and you can see more of this in the preview, is the Alien Hierarchy side. And these guys, this faction has arrived on planet Earth, and they have these massive machines of destruction. And they're extremely cool because they're very customizable in the way that you can build on these gigantic walkers. And you can actually build, like, offensive weapons. You can build defenses and special ability powers and super weapons and things. And basically, they're like a mobile base. They play very different than, other types of factions where you basically build on these assault walkers, and then they basically send a signal up into orbit, and the mothership beams down various troops and vehicles and cool things like that, with this bizarre alien technology. And then we have these cool glyph carvers that actually go and, like, carve, like, the equivalent of crop circles on the ground. And that's basically like a barcode that places an order to the motherships up in orbit of what type of structure to send down for base building.
And
so,
by contrast, the Novus are much smaller and lighter.
Yeah, the Novus now, on the other hand, the Novus are very, very high speed. They're this sentient AI race of sentient machines that are very, all about, they're based on nanotechnology, and they can do all kinds of strange things with electricity, and they're a very they can break themselves down and transport themselves around the map with nanotechnology across, like, these signal lines, and they play very, very different because they're more based on power and signal strength and things like that. So the Novus are just another very differently playing thing where they are more about traditional kind of base building and stuff like that, but they're also about, like, having a network and having connectivity between your nodes to be able to quickly, like, transport units around the map and stuff. So yes, they are a lot smaller, and they're also like a new faction that's really never been seen before in RTS.
I guess you're not talking about the third faction yet, is that correct?
The third faction, as far as I know, is not being talked about yet, but it will be coming very soon.
Great. Well, we'll have to check back with you soon for that. The so you're really concentrating on asymmetry for this game, as opposed to a lot of games that have sides that look different but play pretty much the same.
These guys
play very differently.
Yeah, this is actually, it's been a huge, huge challenge. I got to say, hats off to StarCraft, a game that we absolutely love and admire because, StarCraft really had three very unique sides that played very differently, and they were extremely well balanced against each other. And we, with Empire at War, it was, Rebels versus Empire, and people pretty much knew how Rebels were from Star Wars mythos and how the Empire was. And so, and the fact that we were only two factions bringing in our third faction with the expansion pack. So now it's with Earth Assault, we now have these three factions, and they are all three very, very different to each other. And it's definitely not like, having two factions and you just skin one differently and you have the same types of functionality. The three factions all play, in our opinion, very differently to each other and very differently to traditional RTS that people are used to. And that has been an enormous challenge that we we knew it was going to be a challenge, but now we're living it because we're balancing it. And we're, you know, we're playing multiplayer with it. And the other crazy thing about it is that each side has a customizable tech tree path that they can go down to use this, what Adam calls it, you know, Adam calls this like tactical dynamics, where on the battlefield you can change your strategy at any time. You can kind of change some of your overarching strategies. And this,
and Adam is, sorry?
Oh, Adam Eisgreen is our creative director on the project, and he's really the visionary for Earth Assault. So he's the best one to ask about, you know, all the stuff on the side. I pretty much spend my full time programming on the project. But what we love about it is the fact that even, you know, falling down your tech trees and advancing your tech trees, if you were to play a game, let's say, where you're playing the two factions against each other, like say a Novus versus Novus game or Hierarchy versus Hierarchy, if the players actually advance their tech trees differently, they can have a very different experience and be able to play the game very differently from those. So you can have a really neat battle just between two sides playing against each other, that they wouldn't have all the same abilities and all the same powers and special abilities and stuff like that.
Yeah, but it really struck me as like one of the most difficult things to do in game design is to properly balance an RTS, because there are all these units that have different functions and they interact with each other differently. And you have to have, you know, strengths and weaknesses, and getting that tuned just right so that one team doesn't have a big advantage. It seems like a huge undertaking.
Yeah, and that's what we're actually dealing with right now is, you know, really, well, one, working on getting the stability there, because, you know, most of all the major features have now been programmed. And it's from a technical point of view, it's that interaction between those abilities and how, you know, how different things can, you know, overlap each other and different abilities can play off against each other and null each other out and things like that. So it's, one, is getting the units to actually technically work against each other, you know, in all their different modes and different with their different abilities and things like that. And the other one, yes, is definitely balancing. We're doing, you know, lots and lots more multiplayer now with each other, and we're learning so much within the studio by playing multiplayer against each other. And we have this great test team that are playing it every single day and, you know, giving us great feedback and helping us to balance. And fortunately, we're really lucky because the game is so data-driven with XML and Lua that it's fairly, you know, with all the program, but the bulk of the programming features done, a design can do a lot of tuning and tweaking and behavioral adjustment, all by editing just simple, you know, XML settings in these XML files or modifying Lua scripts. And we're really excited about that too, because that's going to let the mod community, you know, and the hobbyists be able to like create their own factions or modify our factions to play differently. And we think that's going to be, you know, really cool.
And how are things coming along with DirectX 10 effects?
DirectX 10 has come along beautifully. It looks absolutely amazing. Man, these cards run really, really hot. They are you put one of these cards in, and man, currently like it heats up your room. But the everything that's coming along so far, we're really, really excited about. It's looking, you know, absolutely beautiful. I was really impressed by seeing the work that Greg Gjelstrom's doing. He works on the core technology team with me, where we work on new technologies, you know, for the game platforms. And Greg is overseeing. He was the one that created the Alamo engine, and he's the one that has really, really, really worked with his team to upgrade the Alamo engine and working into DirectX 10.
And that's the same engine that you used on Empire at War.
Alamo was the original engine that we used on Empire at War, but we actually, since we started Universe at War Earth Assault, we have had more manpower devoted to technology than any of the other disciplines of, you know, like art, audio, and design. We've had more programmers actually working on the technology to advance, you know, the rendering engine, the audio engine, the AI, you know, the networking, the multiplay, just, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, and a big part of that is the rendering and the, you know, the DirectX 10 initiative to make it really, you know, look phenomenal on those cards. While also trying to really make sure that we can keep a nice minimum spec that, you know, so somebody with, you know, not the ultra uber, you know, high end PC can still have something that looks nice and plays nice. Oh, and that's another thing too. Speaking of which, I wanted to say, when you were talking about the challenges on the balancing of the units, boy, the AI, that has been another huge part, is getting, you know, the AI to recognize the abilities and the strategies that it has based on its tactical dynamics and being able to employ them. Been another huge challenge that we're working on. So far, it's going really good.
And just to give a little background on Petroglyph, you guys are, there's 50% of you came from Westwood, right?
Yeah, yeah. We actually we started Petroglyph 4 years ago, and there's 55 of us here in Las Vegas, and half the staff is from the old Westwood Studios days. We're actually, our building is just down the street from the old Westwood building, and, you know, we have a ton of fond memories, and there was, you know, such an incredible group of talented people at Westwood, and just such nice, great people to be around. We really wanted to, you know, preserve that, and so, you know, we have an all-new company culture, but there's definitely some very strong roots, you know, from Westwood, and we still have
the whole... The whole reason you started up is because you didn't want to move when EA absorbed Westwood, right?
Well, EA absorbed Westwood, and it was actually just a great experience. I mean, we learned so much from being part of EA, and EA is a really fantastic company to work for. I mean, it was really, really great. The hard part was when it came down to the decision to close down Westwood and relocate the teams. And so one team was relocating to Redwood Shores, and the other team was relocating to Los Angeles. And that was the hard part because, you know, after so many years at Westwood, I had been at Westwood for 17 years. I started there in 1986, like right when the company began. And so many of us had, you know, our families here and our homes and our relatives and our parents and our roots and kids in school and just all that. And so we were just so ingrained here in Las Vegas. We had such deep, deep roots. And that was what, more than anything, really got us, you know, to stay here.
Right. And you guys actually did, before you left EA, you did a treatment on CNC3, right?
We were actually, for about a year, we were working in pre-production on Command & Conquer 3 at the Westwood Vegas office. And some of the guys went on to went down to EALA and continued to work on it. The original plan was to continue Command & Conquer 3 down at EALA as they were building the new studio. And there was a pretty large group of us that were working on CNC3. I know Joe Bostic was our tech director. Steve Tall was the lead network programmer. Adam was the creative director. Frank was the lead composer. I was the lead gameplay programmer. And Gary Cox was art director. And Ailey Arabian, I think Ailey was the lead, you know, lead artist. So we had guys from all the disciplines working on CNC3 that actually ended up being here. And I got to tell you, with CNC3 coming out, it's absolutely awesome. EALA just did a phenomenal job on the game. We're digging it so much here. We absolutely love the work that they did, and it just feels such like a tried and true Command & Conquer game, you know, being back in that universe with Joe Cook and his cane and all that stuff. So Command & Conquer is something so near and dear to our hearts, and they did a phenomenal job. They, in our opinion, they just delivered on all fronts, and
yeah,
our hats
that's
off
the best,
to them.
The best endorsement they could possibly get is the, you know, the original CNC team being happy with it.
Oh my gosh, we are so proud of the work they did. I mean, great job to you guys.
So you also did Empire at War. How was it working with LucasArts on that?
Oh man, what an incredible experience. We love those guys. We went to LucasArts when we were starting up Petroglyph. We went to LucasArts at E3 and we went to go talk to them about doing like an action strategy, you know, console game. We had been working on, you know, Xbox and PlayStation 2 at Westwood, and we really, you know, have a vision for how we'd like to see, you know, strategy turn into more of a console-based action strategy game. And so we went to LucasArts and said, hey, what do you guys think about this? And they turned right around and said, well, actually, we would love you guys to do a PC RTS, you know, Windows-based real-time strategy game in the classic Star Wars universe. And our jaws hit the floor because what an opportunity. And the fact that, you know, our team was very proficient, you know, with Windows, and the fact that, you know, since we'd have to create all our technology from scratch, it would be a very, that would be a very good starting move to create Petroglyph. And so that was just what a phenomenal experience working with those guys. I mean, we had such a blast. I mean, the teams there are awesome, and you know, their localization group is phenomenal, their QA group is phenomenal, and their production group, everybody is just great. And the fact that we, you know, got to have access to, you know, the movie assets from some of the new movies, you know, we were sprinkling in some of the new movie units, you know, and also, you know, having access to all the audio libraries from all the Star Wars. I mean, Frank Klepacki was like a kid in a candy store having all those sound effects from the Lucasfilm archives and stuff. And it was
Frank
just a blast.
Frank Klepacki is the guy who did all the original CNC music, right?
Yeah, Frank. I forgot to mention Frank. Yeah, Frank was our. Actually, that's right. I did. Frank started at Westwood at age 16. He was our first playtester. I was programming a game called Circuit's Edge, and Frank came in and was testing it on the Tandy 1000. And so Frank was really into music and was performing in his parents' lounge act on the Strip here in Las Vegas. And Frank just started making music for us and suddenly became Westwood's composer and pretty much composed all the music for almost every game we almost ever did at Westwood. And
yeah,
so Frank's
that's some of the most famous game music out there is the CNC, you know, like especially the march in the beginning of Red Alert.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Incredibly memorable.
And Frank is our only audio guy too, you know, and he is so good at what he does because, you know, he does the audio direction, he does the implementation, he creates new sound effects, he does all the scratch voices, like, you know, for putting in for units and stuff like that. So Frank just does so much amazing stuff, and yet he's still our lone audio guy. And Frank, if you're listening, I promise we're going to get you another audio guy if you're listening to me right now. But
he does a killer Vader impersonation too, I hear.
Yeah, he did. He was the voice of Vader in the Empire at War TV commercial and stuff like that. So yeah, so Frank is well known in the Command and Conquer history. In fact, EALA even came to us and said, "Hey, we really want to use Frank for some Command and Conquer, you know, 3 music," and the poor guy. I mean, Frank is so overloaded with work, you know, composing music for, you know, Earth Assault and the other stuff that's going on. He was just way, 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 his schedule was just way too overloaded. And he's just, man, the guy is just constantly busy.
Yeah, that's one of the few, you know, real deficiencies of CNC 3 compared to the previous ones is that the soundtrack is not quite up to his level, but it gets the job done.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. What really blew me away was the Skrin audio. The audio on the Skrin was just outstanding. You know, in the sound effect work that they did for the Skrin, I thought, wow, that was really, really cool.
But yeah, we gotta move on with the podcast. But it's
okay. Sorry.
Great talking to you, and we'd love to have you back sometime.
Oh man, so, anytime, you guys. I mean, just let me know. I'm happy to talk about all this fun stuff.
Yeah, and when you're ready to talk about the third side or you know, any new developments you guys are working on, we'll love to have you on.
Oh man, it would be my pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
All right, next up is playlist. So Dan, what have you been playing this week?
I have been playing a whole lot of both Supreme Commander and CNC3. I've been off of WoW for a couple weeks now, and suddenly I've got all this time to play other games. It's great. So I've been playing in ranked games on both games. You know, trying to climb the ladder. I think my win ratio is about 66%. So, I'm doing okay for myself. I'm not going to win any competitions, but I have to say I'm enjoying SUPCOM a little bit more. In the multiplayer arena, because lately I've gotten up to like rank 8 or 9 they got tiered multiplayer, they auto match you, so when you do a multiplayer match, so you can you get matched up about the same skill level, and the people I'm going up against now are getting pretty good, and they found some, you know, very difficult to stop strategies. For example, I can hear you typing, guys. For example, they've got Nod has this unit called Shadow Team, which you can build a couple minutes into a game, when most people are still just trying to get their economy going. These guys are stealth, so you can't see them without a stealth detection unit like a guard tower. And they can fly, so they can fly into your base unseen. They land and then they plant charges on your buildings and destroy them. They're kind of like Commando Light in that way. The charges won't automatically destroy every building, but if you get like three or four of these teams into somebody's base, you can destroy just about any building really quickly. So what I've had happen is people will fly these guys in and like destroy my crane, which has a second production queue.
Mm-hmm.
And really just slow me down. And they'll keep doing that. They'll just come in and hit a building, and I'll build defenses and stuff like that, and you know, stop most of them. But some of them get through and really screw up my economy. And they're not that expensive for them to build. So while I'm struggling to keep them out, they're pumping these guys out, and in the meantime, you know, devoting themselves to building up their economy, to ramping up their vehicle production. And all my stuff, all my base defense is centered around stopping infantry. So suddenly in come the tanks and I'm screwed.
You've got to really have a combination of all three types of perimeter defense, though. I found that I was able to negate those shadow teams as long as you've got some anti-air, because you can start attacking them before they can even get down on the ground from the hang gliders, and they're pretty badly damaged at that point, you know, by the time they hit the ground. But
there's no
excuse to not have a decent perimeter of various guard towers around your base.
Well, at a later stage in the game, yes, but I'm talking about very early. These things can come out within 2 or 3 minutes of the game starting, and I guarantee you you don't have a solid base perimeter by then.
I have heard plenty of stories of shadow teams wreaking havoc, but like you said, it's just a new form of rush. Later in the game, when you've got some base defenses up, they're pretty much taken out of the game, I think.
But that's if you survive until later in the game, which is really tricky with these things.
So Gary, you don't think they're imbalanced then?
I don't really feel confident enough to talk about the balance issues fully yet. I mean, I have played quite a bit. I think that any time you throw in a third class or a third race, whatever you want to call it, balance becomes a much trickier proposition both to design and to evaluate. When it was just GDI versus Nod, that was always very straightforward. But now you've got the Skryn in there as well, and the Skryn actually is the race that I've been having the most trouble playing against. When I go online, if I see that someone is playing as Skryn, particularly on a large map, that usually is going to go very poorly for me, because the only way that I've found to win against Skryn is to hit them hard and rush them early and take them out of the game as quickly as you can. Because if you allow them to build and they get air power up, once they've got carriers and those fighters that are so fast, I mean, you're screwed at that point.
You need heavy anti-air at that point.
Yeah, you need crazy, crazy anti-air. And then even crazy anti-air against a big fleet of Skryn carriers, I mean, it takes, you know, with the shield and everything, the shielding that they have, takes a long time to take them down. They can cause a lot of damage.
If there's
an imbalance issue, and this is probably just because I haven't played as the Skryn, I just, you know, this is just my view because I've been beaten up by the Skryn a lot. It feels like for advanced players, Skryn is the way to go. Maybe that's just me.
And that's actually how they described them when I was down there reviewing it. The Skryn are for the people, like the other two sides are people that are you know, casual players. The Skryn are for the hardcore. They take more management skill to especially early in the game to defend your base, because most of their firepower comes out later.
Right, but as you said, an advanced player, a player that's used to this kind of stuff, that knows all the microing and is able to manage all these different units and totally knows how to play a game like this, the Skryn is going to give them the most bang for their buck, because they have some insanely powerful units.
Yeah, those carriers, if you mass them especially, vicious.
Oh, mass carriers, and not just the carriers, but those little midge, I don't know what you call them, but those little midge fighters that swarm around, lethal.
Yeah, well, those are the carriers' fighters.
Right, okay.
So Gary, have you been playing anything else other than CMC3?
Yeah, I've been playing some Counter-Strike Source.
Really?
Mostly just to annoy Jack Thompson. But no, I got back into it just because, I don't know, I've just been jonesing for some FPS action online. I don't know why, I've just been kind of feeling like that's something I kind of want to get back into. And there's not really a lot out there that, like, new on the FPS front that's exciting me. And so I thought, okay, I'll go back to the old classic Counter-Strike, and I found a couple of servers that just run like the 24/7 office map. And I spent the first couple of days just getting absolutely crushed, like literally like 50 deaths, and they wouldn't even get one kill, because these guys that play all the time are just insanely talented. They will headshot you, you know, within a millisecond, you know, from all the way across the map. It's just ridiculous. But as I've been, you know, I've been practicing and getting a little bit better and getting some kills and really enjoying myself, and it's making me now kind of, I've definitely got my eye on things like Crysis and what are going to be the next big online first-person shooters. Because, you know, I love my consoles as well, but when it comes to first-person action, you know, I enjoyed Gears of War and I enjoyed Rainbow Six Vegas on the 360. But with the mouse and the keyboard and a really, really nice graphics card, there's no comparison. Now I just need the games. I need a Crysis. So, I mean, what else is coming out that I would like?
Well, Left 4 Dead and Team Fortress 2. Quake Wars, Unreal Tournament 3. I mean, the end of this year is going to be amazing for first person.
Actually, yeah, I think Left 4 Dead, Team Fortress 2, and what was the other one that we just... Quake Wars, Team Fortress 2 would be the two big ones for me. I really can't wait to get into those.
I'm excited for Unreal, personally.
Does Team Fortress 2 have a hunted mode? Because that was my all-time favorite game that we ever played in the PC Gamer offices, where you have to escort the president through the map.
I'm trying to remember now.
He was kind of like this cowering El Presidente type guy with a suit and an umbrella.
I remember because I used to sometimes play as him.
The terrorists that were trying to take him out?
And no, I would play as the guy with the umbrella, and I would walk around trying to whack everybody with it. I think there is one, but don't quote me on that.
My favorite trick ever in that game, and we used to do it all the time on PC Gamers, when you're attacking... The final courtyard, the escape zone where you have to get the president to win the game, is kind of a garage, and there's an SUV parked there
with its brake lights on.
With the brake lights on, the red lights on, and there was a particular spot where you could hide with a sniper rifle and put the sniper rifle right over the brake lights so that no one could see the red dot, and it was literally like three or four paces from safety for the president. So you could headshot him right there, and it was fantastic. I never got tired of doing that.
Those were the days.
I'm going to correct what I just said. I don't think there is a hunted mode in this one.
I'm going to go on record and say that's a mistake, because that was always the most fun mode in the game, I think.
Just a quick aside, since you mentioned Jack Thompson, I actually read the legal brief that he filed against Kotaku yesterday. I can't believe that he actually used a not joke in a legal document.
A what joke?
A not joke.
After about 90 periods, like a huge long ellipsis.
Yeah.
Not.
Not. Yeah. And he also used the term knucklehead, which I didn't realize it was a legal
further term. Further examples of his unbelievable professionalism.
Yeah, and he's suing the Florida bar, but I'm starting to think that I should sue the Florida bar, because I mean, they're just too incompetent if they can't disbar somebody like this by now. It's just silly. Anyway.
So, Kristen, what are you playing these days?
Well, as you guys in the office know, I've been moving house, so I haven't had access to any my computer or any of my consoles at home, so not much lately, but I did...
So it's like you're playing The Sims.
Yeah, in real life, exactly. So I've been playing the Unpack All of My Stuff game, but...
That's not fun.
Yeah, no, not so much. But I did actually fire up Penumbra last week. I only had a chance to play it for like 20 minutes, so I can't really tell you much yet what I think of it. But stand by for more. So that's what I'm playing right now.
Cool. And Jeremy?
When I'm not playing Peggle, I powered up.
Are you seriously still playing Peggle?
I'm inching my way towards Grandmaster, my friend.
Grand Dragon? What?
I'm very close now. It will
Grandmaster.
Happen. Greg, your EIC and I share a love for an old racing game called Death Cars. And I hadn't played it in a long time, and I was kind of getting the feeling like I wanted a sense of speed. So I tried to play it, and it doesn't play in new modern systems, apparently. So I did something I never had tried before. Apparently you can run programs in XP in a compatibility mode.
Right.
So if you right-click on them, go to properties and stuff, you can actually run them in Windows 98 mode. And it ran great. I think it even supported widescreen, weirdly enough.
Really?
And, it boosted the res way up and ran smooth as butter. And I loved it. Had a great time.
Did you ever play Death Rally?
Yes.
That is like the best racing game ever.
Death, are you talking about the top-down Remedy game?
Yeah. Awesome game.
Yeah, that was fun.
Cool. Well, I've been playing Myst Online Uru Live. I can't talk about it too much because I am reviewing it, but it's been very interesting because, you know, that game was originally supposed to come out after Uru launched like 3 years ago, something like that. And it was canned by Ubisoft. They said, no, we don't think anybody's really going to play online Myst. And so now it's been picked up by GameTap, and it's just been launched by them, and so it's one of their original titles. It's very interesting. It's a new take on massively multiplayer gaming, mainly because there's very little massively multiplayer there. You can see other people, you can interact with other people, but you have to choose to. Otherwise, you're still playing mostly by yourself.
Yeah, wasn't your remark that it's a lot like playing multiplayer Myst is a lot like playing single player Myst because you're the only one there.
You see the same amount of people.
Yeah, that's right.
Despite the fact that Myst obviously was a very successful franchise, it seems like one of the toughest things to transition into the MMO space because it was always a completely solitary experience. There weren't even NPC characters.
Well, actually, in Uru, there were a few NPC characters, so it sort of makes sense.
Oh, I had checked out of the franchise long before then, but you say so.
But I will say this. I will say that it's a great game for GameTap because you can go on there, you can play a little bit, you can get out, and because you don't have to level up like you do in a regular massively multiplayer game, there's no sense that you have to get in there to grind, you know, so it's a pretty much check-in when you want sort of game. Anyway,
Just as a real quick addendum, just because I just literally just got this email and we're talking about MMOs, Guild Wars celebrates its 2-year anniversary on Saturday.
How about that too.
Happy birthday, Guild Wars. All right, well, for all of us here at the PC Gamer Podcast, we'd like to thank you very much for listening to us this week. So on behalf of myself, Kristen Salvatore, Dan Stapleton, Gary Witta, and Jeremy Williams, thank you very much, and come back next week. Also, check out our website at www.pcgamer.com.
And send your questions to pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com.
Subscribe at pcgamer.com/subscribe. And check out showdownland.com for information on our upcoming LAN event.
And also spay and neuter all your pets.
Do not try this.
What an opportunity, you know, it's like, did we lose everyone?
No.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I heard that. I don't know why that happened.
I'm just wondering about this language.
Ian
that's
Stephen
only,
Hawking.
Can anyone hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. We just ignore
sorry,
you.
Sorry, we just weren't listening to you.
Okay. When people constantly interrupt me, I think I can't be heard.
No, we just don't like you. That's all.
Yeah.
All right.
No, so
I like you. I'm just interrupting you.
I don't get ESPN.
Dull. You call me.
I'm sure it'll be online Saturday night. All right. So I'm here with Mike Legg, the CEO. It's CEO, right? Or is it president? I'm sorry.
I'm president of Petroglyph.
Okay.
You want to start over?
I'm going to start over. Yes. Okay. So I'm here with Mike Legg, president of Petroglyph Games. Anna, let me.
No
give me
problem.
One second. Yeah, I'm.
Dan, I believe in you.
You have to clap. You have to clap and I'll wear my wings. There you go. Okay.
You can do it.
Yeah. There we go. Okay.